Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Mradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us is George Avizes, the Military Marketing Director at GE Marine, as part of our continuing coverage of the Surface Navy Association's recent virtual annual symposium. I should note GE Marine, as well as Fincantieri Marinette Marine and Leonardo DRS, sponsored our SNA coverage, where we are a media partner. George, welcome aboard.
Hey, good afternoon, Vagha. Nice to be here.
Absolute pleasure. Happy New Year to you. I wish we were doing this conversation live on the show floor. And I wanted to congratulate you on the victory for the propulsion supplier for the Constellation class frigate, the FFG 62, as it has been designated by our sponsor, Fincantieri Marinette Marine. You guys won with the LM2500 plus G4 engine. Talk to us a little bit about the powertrain for this ship. The order now is for 10 ships, but talk to us about the LM2500 plus G4 and the CODLAG propulsion system that the Navy is adopting for this ship.
It's good to interact with you and talk a little bit about this program. We're excited is that the U.S. Navy is going to be getting a new engine in its fleet. You know, as you know, the LM2500 and the LM2500 Plus are in the current fleet. But now the G4 will join them. And that's a powerful 30.3 megawatt U.S. Navy rated day engine. But that engine is fully proven and is on board 27 international ships, including 10 ships for the Italian firm. And as you mentioned, that is a CODLAG arrangement. And there's also applications on 10 French firms, which are CODLAG, and other PPA frigates. So we're pleased to bring that engine into the fleet. And keep in mind, as we normally do within GE, as we leverage our industrial base, where there's over 1,100 of those engines operating in the industrial applications.
And talk to us a little bit about what CODLAG means, right? For the navalists in the audience, they get it. But for the folks from the other services, they might not understand what this new powertrain is like and how it differs from the arrangement that the United States Navy has traditionally used for its large surface combatants.
Yeah. You know, for example, the DDG-51s is an all-gas turbine ship that provides propulsion, and there's gas turbine generator sets for ship service. Here, this means combined diesel, electric, and gas turbines. So at low loitering speeds, the diesel generators will provide power to the hybrid electric drive motors to drive the ship up to, say, around 16 knots for economical operation. And then for a sprint speed where you want to be very responsive, that's where the gas turbines come in. And then even at the top end speed, say 26 knots or greater, you have the diesel electric propulsion to the motors as well as the gas turbine. So it's primarily the most economical way to get the most power with less amount of equipment or smaller gas turbines to meet your top end speed and your reliability requirements.
And that's obviously because historically, when you're running the gas turbine, even though the LM2500 is a great engine, you're actually burning up more gas at slow speed, right? I mean, the gas turbine is much more efficient when it's running at higher power settings than at lower power settings. And now with this propulsion train, you get that flexibility to do low speed operations and extend the range of the ships. Let me ask you about what's next on the program. And I want to get to the one GE model in a second, which you guys have transitioned to. But talk to us a little bit about what's next for this program. Obviously, we talked to Admiral, retired United States Navy Vice Admiral Rick Hunt, who's the top executive at Fincantieri Marinette Marine. Obviously, a very big win for the company. Right now, we're in configuration management for those 10 ships. Talk to us about the schedule that you guys are on to make sure that the engine and that propulsion train is ready to go into those ships.
Yeah, thank you. Keep in mind, our engines in the version that we're providing here is going to use our lightweight composite module, which is, as we talked in the past, saves 50% of the wall weight reduction. We've built that and we've already operated the gas turbine in that configuration. So that is fully qualified. Presently, we've already had a kickoff meeting with Fink and Tiari on this, and our team is working together to ship this equipment by the end of 2022. And that's because, as I mentioned, we've already done a lot of the work or pre-qualified this equipment, and we're providing a full complement of auxiliary systems to support this, be it electric start, which is another feature to reduce weight, which is proven internationally, and as well as the gas controls, turbine control system and others.
Which contrasts to how the U.S. Navy has done it, which is compress their start for an auxiliary and then use the bleed air from the auxiliary to start the main engines.
Yeah, yeah. And we found that this option with electric start is very reliable, and it also saves weight. You know, I really do that versus on the hydraulic. And it really sets us up for the future for electric drive ships. You know, it would absolutely make sense to use that type of system. But getting back to you on this program, we're excited. You know, it's now out there as a potentially a 20-ship program. You look at the 30-year shipbuilding program that just came out, and they're looking to ramp this up, say, from 10 FFG-62s in the next 5 years to potentially 15, and maybe the total number beyond 20. What that is, I don't know, but it's a good sign for this ship that the Navy's looking for this frigate, and we're glad to be on it.
And what's the value of the contract for you guys on the propulsion side of that? Have you guys released a total contract value, or if you could give us an estimate on what that's worth, sort of top line side?
We kind of don't put out our top line numbers and things, you know, because we're very competitive here in the U.S. and other international navies, and so we typically don't put out our top line numbers on that. So.
Okay, understood. Let's talk very briefly. I want to get to the other programs you guys are going to be competing for. Obviously, the Navy is looking at several new ships, including large surface combatant, but as well as the Tagos ocean surveillance ship. But first, talk to us briefly about 1GE, because over the last number of years, you guys really have reorganized the business so that it's sort of a broader effort as opposed to a unit or division effort. Talk to us a little bit about what that's meant in terms of the competitiveness of the company.
Yeah, thank you, Bhargav. We didn't do any structural reorganization of the business, but we just came to the realization that the Navy is looking for integrated, optimized propulsion and power solutions. And if you look at GE's portfolio, it really makes sense for us to work together. One, it saves us time and money because of customer touch time and marketing, but it also adds a lot of value to the customers. And specifically, that's with not only GE Marine and gas turbines, but GE Power Conversion for hybrid and full electric drive. And we also employ our GE Research organization with over 1,000 scientists of what we could do for advanced technology, say, for example, autonomous systems. And likewise, GE Digital and GE Additive, you know, ways to increase fleet readiness and reduce maintenance. So we've got a good thing going as far as working together and really giving full complementary solutions to the Navy.
Let's talk a little bit about future programs. You guys are obviously interested in the Tagos X. That's the ocean surveillance ship that would replace the Implacable class, as well as the large surface combatant, which is going to be the next DDG, effectively. Talk to us a little bit about what kind of timescales you're looking at. And you guys pride yourselves on a modular design to be able to scale from a higher end of power to a lower end of power. Talk to us about how it is you're looking at both of these programs and what are the opportunities. And I should also point out, right, that the FFG-62 powertrain is also going to be on the LUS-V, right? The large unmanned surface combatant or large unmanned surface vehicle is going to have this same powertrain on it to make sure that the Navy has both flexibility and commonality.
Yeah, thank you, Vago. The first is Tagos is the acoustic surveillance ship. It's a swath design, shallow water area twin hull. And that ship has a requirement for 25 megawatts of gas turbine generator set, which lines up right in our sweet spot of our LM2500 plus or plus G4 that we were just talking about. It needs the amount of power because of the ship requirements for speed at the high sea states. So we've been working with the Navy on a design that that fits. And so we're very pleased with that. The program is currently undergoing industry studies by four shipyards, and GE Power Conversion is very active supporting them as providing motors and full electric drive motors, drives, and automation and control systems. So we expect that program, these studies, to end mid this year, later an RFQ to come out for the ship. And we expect or hope our efforts pay off on the gas turbine generator set and as well as the electric propulsion system. The second program you mentioned is the large surface combatant, which is critical for us. That's a replacement of the DDG-51, probably to happen, you know, early 2030s for the first ship. But on that, the Navy's has expressed a lot of interest in the FFG-62 gas turbine module that we were just talking about, where we use that in a generator set application. And as you mentioned, we do have this module design where all three frames of our LM2500s, be it 22, 26, or 30 megawatts, all fit in the same footprint. And that's very attractive to the Navy because as they go from future block, how do they increase power with little to no change to the ship? So we're working with the Navy on that. And as you heard, there's the integrated test facility that the Navy and Congress is talking about as proving out equipment. Ourselves and Power Conversion are in a, I think, a very good position to help support the Navy in that and the objectives of proving out surrogate and equipment before things are fully fielded. And so I think we're looking forward to working with the Navy in that.
And do I understand correctly that this powertrain is the same powertrain that's likely to be in the LSV?
LSV is undergoing studies right now, a number of people. They're looking at all options, Vago. They're looking, frankly, at diesels. They're looking at hybrid electric. And some may be looking at gas turbines. And so we want to or are reaching out to the six entities that have gotten studies. And, hey, what can the 1GE offer them? Be it gas turbines, hybrid electric drive, our GE research with our autonomous high assurance and trusted systems that you need to make sure any communications and things work, as well as in GPS denied environments, you know, so some of the high level technology there. So that's really where the 1GE is also coming into play.
George, thanks very much. Really appreciate it and can't wait to see you again so we can talk in person. All the best.
Hey, thank you, Vago. Enjoy. Thanks.
And joining us now, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, always a pleasure having you back on.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Vago. Thank you so much.
Feels like my weekly home, Vago. Thank you.
Yes, Alan Wasalan. Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome home. Before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report, and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette, Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics, Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. All right. America has a new president as the coronavirus pandemic unfortunately continues to wreak havoc, not just in the United States, but around the world. U.S. casualties are now, I think, beyond 410,000 as lockdowns and travel bans are expanded, something, Sash, unfortunately, you know better than almost anybody else. President Biden has announced his new pandemic response plan that requires masks and physical distancing on federal property, as well as other strictures, and he's seeking another $1.9 trillion in stimulus and more later on in the year as another 1.3 million Americans went on unemployment. Republicans, surprise, 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 aren't all that much interested in more stimulus and are being back to being debt conscious. Biden has also asked his administration to assess the threat from domestic extremists in the wake of the January 6 attacks, in which 135 people have already been charged. Ron, you were kind enough to join us on Inauguration Day, but obviously there's been a couple more days of trading since then. Walk us through where the market's head is on defense and aerospace now that we're a couple of days into the Biden administration, you know, and how the administration's pandemic response plans are being received.
It was largely a quiet week in the market. If you look at the Dow Industrials, they were essentially flat. Most of the A&D universe, commercial and defense, were pretty flat. The S&P was up a smidge. So anyway, I think the market was anticipating what happened this week. So there wasn't a heck of a lot going on. We're in in the midst of earnings season. Last week was the beginning of it. This week in the A&D sector, there's about 14, maybe 15 companies reporting this week. So there's going to be a lot of news flow this week. So I think investors were just, quiet, positioning themselves for the upcoming earnings season. When you look at interest rates, they held pretty steady on the week. They were up maybe a smidge. And then oil prices were pretty steady on the week. So, the commodity markets, rates markets, the equity markets, you didn't see much going on.
And very quickly, who reported and what are your expectations for the group that's to come?
Yeah, so this upcoming week, we've got a lot. We've got Hexcel, Crane, Lockheed, Raytheon, GD, Boeing, all the big guys, and then some of the smaller ones. So I think by the end of this week, by the podcast next week, we should have a good feel for what happened in the sector. I think we all know, but more importantly, what management teams are thinking about into next year. So there should be a lot to discuss about that in the upcoming week.
And of course, I was also going to say that everybody was sort of distracted by this bizarre GameStop drama, right? Between short sellers. I mean, it's just an unbelievable squeeze how some hedge funds are now like sort of $3 billion in the hole on an obscure company that, I didn't even know was still in business at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen all kinds of crazy moves like that. And stuff like that's, I think the frequency of it's, it's been more common over the last couple of years than it was years ago.
Yeah, it's utterly stunning. Sash, extraordinary lockdown, things getting much tougher in the United Kingdom. And arguably, countries are beginning to do the stuff that they should have been doing in March, right? A couple of weeks of tight lockdown, as we've been discussing, could have spared everybody. It would have been short, sharp, and then V-shaped instead of just dragging on and on and on. First, as a European, sort of give us your sense on what your takeaways were from Biden's inauguration and how folks are viewing it. And then talk to us a little bit about where we are on the pandemic, certainly on your side of the Atlantic, and what's to come, both together with the United States, with Europe, as well as on a national level.
Okay, I mean, look, from a European point of view, I mean, there was huge relief that the inauguration passed absolutely without incident. And, there has been a peaceful transition of power. It's astonishing that I should have to say that about the United States of America. But, given where we were a couple of weeks ago, that was by no means a given. I think that if the pandemic was not going on, the sense of relief and, sense of relief in European capitals you'd be feeling it over your side of the Atlantic. As it is, European governments have been incredibly focused, arguably over-focused on dealing with the pandemic. And it's probably been a good thing for politicians just not to have to worry about stuff coming out of left field from the USA this week, because there have been so many other things to worry about. The one thing that I would bring up, and you know, I think Richard and Ron's and your own views on this would be very interesting, is that there is a sort of hope in some European capitals, and I mean, you know, in descending order, France, Germany, UK, Spain, that a Biden administration will bring to an end the WTO case between Boeing and Airbus on the basis that it's mutually destructive. You know, there's pretty much broadly shared guilt, whatever the hell guilt is. And the last thing that the civil aerospace industry needs is tariffs being applied with a trowel on both sides of the Atlantic. In some cases, they're on national treasures like Scotch whiskey. In other cases, they're on things that really matter, like civil aerospace components, assemblies, and aircraft. So there is a hope in some European capitals that this whole thing may now be brought to a close. I hope personally that these expectations don't get overblown, because if there is no move on that, then tariffs is going to be one of the many things that sort of holds the civil aerospace industry back in 2021.
Richard, your sense, not just on the inaugural, but also what some of the administration's pandemic response features mean for commercial air travel, and how you guys all think in turn, and I want to go around the horn on this, affects production rates at Airbus and ATR, which reported, right? And Airbus, you know, we all knew rates were going to change. It's just we didn't think Airbus was actually going to increase the A320 rate. Sort of give us your broad sweep and then start us off on, you know, certainly on the response side of things, but also on what it means for production.
Yeah, you know, I think the most interesting aspect is that it basically adds top governmental cover for the people at the lower levels who want to do the right thing and have been trying to do the right thing all along. In particular, civil aviation has really taken the lead on mask regulations and whatever else, and testing and requirements for, you know, just general safety procedures, partly, of course, in light and self-interest. But, you know, Steve Dixon at the FAA had announced his zero tolerance policy. If anyone at the federal government other than that had done it for, you know, in a broader way, they'd be accused of being Democrats and pro-maskers or some such nonsense. So basically, civil aviation has been ahead of this curve, and that's really good. It's nice to see the rest of the government following and doing the right thing, I think. And hopefully that means we'll be able to avoid, another couple of months of carnage. So that's all good. What does it mean for, you know, orders? Obviously, you have to get to traffic first. I think it really helps feed into my narrative, and I think it's a lot of people's narrative at this point, that the second half of the year is going to be a really great traffic recovery. We just have to get through the next 6 months as the vaccine is distributed, etc., and of course as hopefully we can keep the new strains of the virus from spreading too quickly. That's obviously a very big concern right now, but you know, assuming we can do that, I'm still a big believer in the idea that the market begins to recover sometime in 2022, 2023.
And what about, obviously, right, the Biden administration wants to put 100 million shots and 100 million arms in the next 100 days. Obviously, there are people who say that the administration is sort of underselling it. Others have said that that's a little bit too ambitious. Obviously, we hope for all of our sakes, the more shots that we get, the merrier. What about the production rate on Airbus and ATR? Kind of give us your sense on whether or not this was a good call by Airbus to be increasing production rather than dialing it back.
Well, you know, they wanted to get to rate 47. Right. And this was sort of a face-saving way of getting a little bit above where they are, but slightly lower. You know, it barely moves the needle, really. And given the fact that these things tend to fluctuate in terms of deliveries, and they tend to, you know, mysteriously take a week or two off here and there in the schedule, I'm not so sure it means much more than putting a brave face on the market outlook. You know, and one of the other aspects of it, it's kind of ironic or just a bummer, that the one plane that I think a lot of the market kind of wants, the A321neo, especially the XLR, that's a question of production difficulties. It has been for some time since they had to, you know, reform the line over at Hamburg. So in other words, part of the question is how many 321 Neos can they pump out relative to the rest? You know, the rest, it's not really clear. It's in a particularly better place than the 737 MAX 8. You know, the A320 Neo is basically tied. It's the 321 that people want, and that's still subject to production constraints.
Ron, give us your sense on the production rate, where you think traffic figures are going to be going, right? I mean, I should have said that Airbus justified the increased rate, saying it expects huge demand, so it wants to try to get ahead of it. But Richard did give us kind of an update on where we are on the 320. And there's, of course, the question also about the ATR and what happens there. Give us kind of your take on all of that.
Yeah, I agree with Richard's view on traffic, although maybe I'm just a little more cautious. You know, we're still looking for, you know, a recovery back broadly to 2019 levels in 2023, largely because of what's going to happen in business traffic. It seems completely reasonable that if indeed the vaccines get distributed and everything kind of works, that you'll see a big recovery in leisure travel for sure. I mean, who do you know that doesn't want to go somewhere, right? I mean, it's kind of that simple. But, you know, on the Airbus rates, it's granted it was, you know, a more maybe subdued increase, but still it was an increase, right? So obviously, I mean, I think that's a good thing, right? One. And two, we'll see what Boeing has to say this week, right? They report on Wednesday. I think it really also kind of supports this view that, you know, Airbus coming out of this is in a better position than Boeing. And then we've been talking many times about the market share shift and so on and so forth. It just plays into that narrative as well.
Sash, your sense on where we are and address the ATR question?
I'm coming out as, I think, rather consistently as the sort of rather grumpy bear in this whole process. But I thought what was fascinating about the Airbus statement was the comment in it, lower for longer. As Richard rightly points out, Airbus was originally planning to get up to rate 47 in the third quarter. Now they're saying rate 43 and 45 in the fourth quarter. But all they're doing there is, and the phrase they use is protecting the ability to go up to that, which is, and this is the signaling they're giving to their subcontractors. Airbus is, in our view, very, very focused on making sure that their subcontractors don't cut capacity in such a way that they lose the optionality to raise production rates later on. So they have to keep on giving these signals. And in our view, they're signals that are not justified by the underlying market, but they have to keep on giving these signals that, you know, we Airbus are going to raise rates. But I think that if Boeing makes any sort of statement on this week about not getting to 31 737 maxes a month by the end of this year, you know, possibly just having a smoother, slower ramp up of the max, I think Airbus will dial those production rates back straight away. You know, we talked about this before. They're playing a game of production chicken in this. Neither wants to be the first to cut, but they really don't want to be producing all these aircraft if they can possibly you know, get away with it. And what was fascinating about ATR, which is the turboprop joint venture between Airbus and Leonardo, and it rules the turboprop market. It's got 90% of the regional turboprop business, sometimes 95%. But ATR had a truly dreadful year last year. They delivered 10 aircraft last year compared to 68 the year before. Peak was well over 100. Five orders, really, who cares? This business is down on its knees. And it's a really interesting example of at the bottom end of the market, where the customers are arguably weakest. But however hard ATR tries, however hard Airbus and Leonardo individually and together tried, they just can't get those aircraft into the operators' hands because the operators can't afford it. And that sends a very, very interesting signal about what the market a little bit further up, over 100 seats, looks like at the moment. So, you know, our view is this Airbus production rate increase is not in stone by any stretch of the imagination. If Boeing pulls back a bit on the 737 MAX, and given underlying pretty weak airline trading in the first or in the last week or so, Airbus will pull back again because the market really doesn't justify more than about 30 A320s a month. 43, 45, nah.
You know, we've been talking about Airbus. Let's talk a little bit about Boeing and the 737 and news flow that we've had about the 787. Richard, start us off on the MAX and the Dreamliner.
Yeah, you know, you've got obviously the persistence of a very large inventory of 787s, I believe 60 or 70. The likelihood of more coming from Norwegian as it abandons all hope of being an international carrier. And then, of course, you know, the persistence of a relatively high output rate at the 787 line, or lines, I guess it's still technically two before they close Everett. That's inevitably, I think, going to result in some kind of rate reduction announcement when they come up with their year-end numbers in a few days. I don't see any way to avoid it, really. The 787 is the most successful and popular wide-body right now, which means exactly nothing.
Ron and Sash?
Yeah, maybe I'll jump in on the 787. I think the key we're watching, particularly as Boeing reports this week, is did they deliver any aircraft in January? How close are they to delivering aircraft? Because remember, it's complicated by the fact that you had some customers who couldn't get the airplanes. But then also they've had this production issue with the shims and the back of the fuselage and some other issues. If they don't deliver 787s this quarter, I think it'll be three quarters they haven't delivered them because of the shims. And then all of a sudden you start getting into the situation where, you know, as interesting as it might seem, I mean, we've seen this before with the 737, customers can start asking for penalties because they're not getting their airplanes. Even if they don't want them, they can still ask for penalties. So I think it's critical for Boeing to deliver 787s this quarter. And that's one of the things we're watching closely.
Sash?
Just very quickly, I'll pick up on Rich's point on the EASA and the MAX. I think it is very unlikely that the European Parliament has any ability to stop the recertification of the MAX, and it said it doesn't have the competence to do so. So I think, you know, there may well be a great deal of hot air, and, you know, parliamentarians the world over have very, very similar characteristics, but I don't think that's the issue with the MAX at this stage. The issue with the MAX at this stage is lack of competitiveness of the MAX across the range with the A320, because as Richard said, you know, what everybody wants is A321s at the moment, which is the top end of the A320 range, and a general weak market. And, you know, Europe is not a big market for the 737 MAX. You know, Ryanair is the dominant operator in Europe, but Europe, perhaps unsurprisingly, is very much A320 country.
I want to shift to national security and get your guys' take on the priorities, programs, and spending that's likely to go towards the fighting of domestic extremists in the United States in the wake of January 6th. The president has asked the FBI, CIA, Homeland Security to assess the violent extremist threat in the United States. After 9/11, we launched two wars that shaped trillions of dollars in U.S. Defense spending. Let's go quickly around the horn, right? What is this going to be, a big investment, a little investment? I mean, obviously, there are legal constraints, right? We've built a fearsome global intelligence network that in general can't be turned as easily against Americans in the United States than it can terrorists on the other side of the world. Ron, let's start with you and just kind of go around the horn.
Yeah, I mean, one place where it seems to jump out at me, you know, purely from a market perspective, is you would think it would drive increased spending on cybersecurity, right? And those contractors that have cybersecurity businesses would therefore benefit. As you pointed out, it gets complicated, right? Because many of the issues you have collecting intelligence externally are different, and you run into legal issues collecting intelligence internally, right? So there's probably a whole aspect of it that has to deal more with the legality of how you execute something like this as opposed to just the technology. But one could imagine that you'll have increased spending on cyber.
Sash, do you have a view on this?
I remember after 9/11, the huge focus on spending on airport security. The airport security just went up. It didn't go up one notch. Again, this is sort of Spinal Tap stuff. It went up to 11. And the layers of machines required to check carry-on baggage, to check hold baggage, to check the individuals going through the airports, and indeed then tying that into various watch lists and so forth, worldwide, absolutely took off. I mean, we probably, some of our listeners forget that the TSA was created after 9/11. And, the whole process of travel security, the industry of travel security, is a 9/11 construct. I therefore don't see any change whatsoever in spending on travel as a consequence of a focus on any domestic extremism in the US or indeed in Europe. And, clearly Europe has got and has had consistent worries about extremism left and right, religious and non-religious. I don't see any change at all. I think the systems actually are there and systems work well. Cyber spending, yeah, probably. Problem with cyber spending, I always think, is that it sounds phenomenally exciting. Cyber businesses sound exciting. Within the companies we look at, they're tiny by comparison with big hardware programs. So I don't think this is, that actually that's the issue. What I do think, though, is that security, both personal security as a result of health and establishment security as a result of concerns about extremism, none of this makes travel easy. And the harder you make travel, the more you discourage the marginal traveler from taking that marginal flight. And those are the people who make the profits in this industry, and hence the growth, and hence the orders for aircraft.
Richard, what's your sense?
As sort of a flip side of me being a vaccine fundamentalist, I think a lot of the problem with travel kind of goes away with the elimination of the disease is a major factor. With regard to the other aspect, what are the opportunities for dealing with extremism in our society? I'd agree with Ron. It's all about the cyber. And it's also kind of important to note, the UK experience back after the issue with the troubles in the 1980s, and how London got completely wired up to be the most cameraed city in the world. I think we could see an element of that here too. And certainly anyone who's spent time in Israel knows that there's an awful lot of gimbaled surveillance devices and God knows what else. King Air's flying overhead in figure eights nonstop. I think it just falls under the heading of more ISR and more of it on home turf than we would feel comfortable with. But that's just an unfortunate price to pay.
Well, and every single person, right, who's ever been to Israel knows you open your bag, whether you're going into a mall or anywhere else, right? I mean, surveillance is ubiquitous, whether it's electronic or visual surveillance. Ron, I want to go to you in a second, but let me ask you one other question, Richard. So many prominent defense and aerospace contractors have cut their funding to the 147 members of the Senate and the House who voted to disenfranchise, effectively backed President Trump's lie of a rigged election in order to be able to stop voter enfranchisement, right? At the end of the day, does that survive? Or is this something that's very, very temporary? Because at the end of the day, some of the people that you're dealing with are very senior lawmakers, including ranking members of important committees, whether House Armed Services or others.
Yeah, I don't think it lasts very long. I think this was a reaction to an extremely unpleasant set of events. And obviously, everyone was very concerned given the environment. But I think things will cool off a bit. There might be a few people who still have a bit of a radioactive patina around them that, is understandable. I think the most interesting aspect of this, I think the odds are still against the whole Trump threat of creating a Patriot Party. But in the event it happens, either because of him or his supporters, it basically destroys the Republican Party chances. And the consequences of the right side of the House being split could easily be some weakness in defense spending, quite a lot of weakness in defense spending moving forward. If the U.S. basically turns into a 50%, 25%, 25% political story, that's not going to be good at all for defense spending.
The classic duopoly issue, if I can boil it down to commercial aerospace terms. Ron, very quickly, your sense on all of this, and also talk to us about some space landmarks this week, including the Virgin orbital test.
So why don't I start out with Virgin Orbit, because I don't have much to add to what Richard said on that. You know, Virgin Orbit had a test of their Launcher One system, which is a small rocket system. That launches off of the wing of a 747. The 747 they use is named Cosmic Girl. And it was a good victory for them. I think it was about less than a year ago, maybe 9 months ago, it's probably about right. Last February, I think it was, or last March, they had a launch that didn't, they attempted to do the same thing and it didn't work out quite as well. So, you know, they bring to the market, this is yet another player in the commercial space market with another low cost, launch capability. Now, what's interesting about what they do is they can launch basically from anywhere because it's off the wing of an airplane. So if you're trying to position smaller satellites, you know, one of the issues when you do something like a CubeSat is you catch a ride with somebody else's launch and then you have to get into the right position. They can just put you directly in the right position because they can launch from basically from wherever they want. So it's yet another move in this steady trend forward that we've seen in commercial space. So, you know, as we all know, you have Virgin Orbit, you've got Virgin Galactic, you've got SpaceX, you got many others. Momentous Space is another one out there that people are talking about. So yeah, this is, you know, just as the kind of, you know, the flywheel moves forward on the market for commercial space.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Always an honor and pleasure. Looking forward to having you guys back on. And Ron, getting your sense on all the earnings that are coming out. Thanks again, guys, and have a great week.
Yeah, great to be here, Vago. Thank you.
Thanks, as always, Vago.
Yeah, really appreciate you having us on. Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.